In the book of Esther, we have a book that is quite strange because the word God never appears. This caused Martin Luther such a problem that he didn't want Esther to be a part of the Old Testament canon. Song of Solomon doesn't mention the name God either. But this is no problem for the child of God, because just as we can read a history book and see the workings of God throughout history without it mentioning the name of God, so can we in these books of the Bible. They don't even mention the name of God. The king that is mentioned here in verse 1, your versions most likely will say Ahasuerus or something like that. That's close to the pronunciation I suppose you would use. I don't know how to pronounce ancient Persian, but they spelled this word K-H-S-H-A-Y-A-R-S-H-A-N, and I suppose that's something like Kesherishan. The Hebrew attempt to repeat it resulted in Ahasuerus in our translation. The Greeks did the easiest of all when they called him Xerxes. Now, this man was ruling around 485 to 464, and verse 1, in mentioning him, talks about this great feast that he held. Verse 2 mentions, in the New King James, Shushan, and the others, Susa, the citadel, his winter residence. And in verse 3, in the third year of his reign, which would make it around 483 B.C., he made a feast for all his officials. And in verse 4, he was quite the show-off, as many kings were. He showed them his riches and his power. Ancient history tells us that it was at this time that he was planning his Greek campaign. His father Darius had gone to Greece to whip the Athenians into line, and they beat his socks off at a little place called Marathon, the plains of Marathon. And when Pheidippides ran the 26 or so miles from the plains of Marathon to Athens and say, we've gained the day, and then fell down dead from his efforts, when he still run marathons in his honor, Darius went home defeated and very bitter, and he determined that every time he ate a meal, someone was to stand there next to him and say, remember the Greeks. Well, he died before he could return to avenge these people. And so his son, Xerxes, determined that he would go and do what his father was incapable of doing. He would beat the Greeks. Well, he got there and he didn't do any better. So this is about a year before he left, according to secular history. He won a small battle, but lost a lot of time at Thermopylae, then went to a couple of other places and got his socks beat off and went home. And according to secular history, took pleasure in his harem, which is exactly what the first couple of chapters of Esther are all about. So this is in sync with secular history. Verse 5 tells us that when these days were complete, he made a feast for all the people. And it describes the things that were going on. And I know that some of you are interested in names, either for your children or your grandchildren, but verse 10 mentions one of my favorites. He had some men who were his eunuchs. One of them's name was Carcass. I'll throw that out for your consideration. One of my favorites in the entire Bible. Verse 11 and 12 mentions Queen Vashti, who was supposed to come before the king publicly to show her beauty, and she refused, and that was not a politically correct thing to do. And so, while on the inside the king acts calm, on the real inside of this man, he is furious. I don't know if his face turned red and he showed what was really going on down inside, but he's the world monarch, and he has shown in verse 4, look at everything I own. I'm the king of the world. But now, who really wears the pants in Persia? Is it Xerxes or is it Vashti? And because of this, those who had access to the king's presence in verse 14 ask, verse 15, what should we do to Queen Vashti? We have to save face. And also because what she's done has been more or less a great insult, not just against the king, but it's going to cause a movement of all the women against their husbands. If the greatest man of all the age can have a wife who doesn't come when he beckons, then what about the rest of us average folks? So this will start a women's liberation movement for sure. So there are going to be a lot of female jokes, a lot of angry men, a lot of unrest, women's liberation movement. We're going to have to do something. So in verse 19, the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be altered. And they say, make this law according to your royal position. Find one who's better. That if she won't come when she's called, she won't come anymore at all. You just put her away and get another. And that's what he determined to do. In chapter 2, You get the impression now the wine is worn off. He's in a sober moment of introspection and reflection, and he thinks back about what he's done, and there's some easiness. He's trapped in this law that has put him in a position where he cannot get his wife back, and he's starting to regret that. You act in haste and you repent in leisure, is the old saying. Well, if he manages to find a loophole that allows him to get Vashti back and she becomes queen again, these seven men who plotted against her are history. So they get the king's attention on something else. They say, what we really need here is a Miss Persia contest. We need a royal beauty contest. We want you to find the fairest maiden in all the land. Get all the beautiful young virgins to come, and you determine which of these you like better than any. Of course, you keep all, but you choose one for your ultimate. Well, in verse 5 of chapter 2, in Susa the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. And it gives his family history. Verse 6 says, Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem, but being a descendant of Kish and Shimei means he's of the lineage of King Saul, which is important for what we'll see in chapter 3. And in verse 7, he had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther. Hadassah means myrtle. We're studying the book of Myrtle this evening. He had brought her up, and it's his uncle's daughter, so she's his cousin. And she was very beautiful, but he had told her not to let anyone know that she was a Jewess. And so she had not done so, verse 10. She had listened to what he said. And in verse 11, every day he paced back and forth to see what was going on. Servants like to tell how much they know. Can you tell me what's going on with this beautiful young lady that I brought up, Esther? How's it going with her? And the rest of chapter 2 shows the success of this endeavor. In verse 16, Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus. It mentions this was in the seventh year of his reign. This would be about around 479 B.C. by now. He loved her more than all the other women. She obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. He set the royal crown upon her head, made her queen instead of Vashti, and made a great feast, the Feast of Esther. Now in verse 20, when Esther had not revealed her family and her people as Mordecai had charged, then in verse 21, in those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of his eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious. Now, I don't know what this is all about. I've speculated that it's because there are no eligible young ladies in this land. The king has snatched them all up. That's enough to make young men furious. But whatever is the reason, they determined to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. We might say lay hands on suddenly and not with affection. Mordecai finds out about this. He informs the king through Esther. And in verse 23, when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed and both were hanged on a gallows, which is not a noose around the neck. They were the ones who invented the prototype of the crucifixion, only theirs was a huge stake driven to the ground with a point on the top on which they would take a person's body and just pull him down on it like a fish on a hook. The Romans perfected it so that a person would stay in agony much longer, because this was too quick and you didn't suffer enough. Now, in chapter 3, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the third or fourth major character that we've seen in this section. And he is called an Agagite. Now, the only thing I know about Agag and Agagites goes back to 1 Samuel 15. You remember that King Saul was given the commission to punish the Amalekites because of Exodus 17, when the children of Israel were leaving Egypt, the Amalekites came and attacked them in the rear, attacking their old folks and the young people that were lagging behind. It was what Louis L'Amour would call dry gulching. You wait till the fellow gets by, shoot him in the back. This is about as low as you can get. And it's very similar to the terrorist tactics that you see today. They're afraid of a face-to-face confrontation, but they'll wait till your back is turned and then try to destroy you when you can't fight back. Well, that's what they had done. And so, there in Deuteronomy 25, God's message was, you're to live in perpetual enmity against the Amalekites for the rest of your days. Well, 400 long years pass. You come to the days of King Saul, and God says, you remember what happened 400 years ago? Twice as long as we've had this nation almost. God's mills grind slowly, but they grind small. Remember the old saying? And so, 400 years have passed. No man could have taken vengeance after 400 years. God can. So he sends Saul, destroy every one of them. Well, Saul doesn't do his job. He spares the best of the flock. He spares Agag. If you read the rest of 2 Samuel and all through Chronicles, you'll see there are several Agagites or several Amalekites who were around, Saul didn't come close to doing his job. And now, 500 years after Saul's failure, the children of Israel are in great danger because the former generation didn't do its job. This just shows the nature of apostasy. What seems so harmless in one generation, let a little time go by and you'll see great strides have been taken. And that's what takes place here. Haman here is advanced above all the princes who are with him. And everybody bowed to pay honor to him, except the last part of verse 2, Mordecai. Now why is this? David many times would bow before Saul and others. Others would bow before David. There was nothing wrong in itself in bowing to pay homage to a man, if you do it in the proper spirit. And the Old Testament is filled with that. But Mordecai would not bow before this man. Why? Remember Exodus 17, Deuteronomy 25? You don't show respect to these people. You're to be in perpetual enmity against them. That's the only explanation I could have for his not doing so. Well, they asked Mordecai about this. Why do you transgress the king's command? Verse 4, he had told them he was a Jew. And in verse 5, when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, he was filled with wrath. Here's the one fly in his ointment. He's a proud, cocky kind of fellow. Sold on himself, like a little Benny Rooster walking around, drawing attention to himself. Oh, what a great, wonderful fellow I am. But here's some fellow who doesn't think so. I'll show him. So in verse 6, he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. Here you have 1 Samuel 15 in reverse. What's taking place in 1 Samuel 15? God comes to Saul and he says, destroy all the Amalekites. Spare none. Now, Haman, an Amalekite apparently, an Agagite, wants to destroy all the Israelites and spare none. 1 Samuel 15 in reverse. Well, in verse 7 of the first month, the 12th year, now we have around 474 B.C. Some 5 years have passed. The 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot. Here is the use of astrology. I know people who won't get up without looking at their horoscope. This book is a good book to show you what that's worth. But they determined by the astrological charts, they were big on this, the Magi were obsessed with the positions of the heavenly bodies, and they said, here is the very best time in which to accomplish this destruction of the nation of Israel. And it would be, the last part of verse 7, the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, which is around our March, April of the year, about the time when the children of Israel are observing their Passover, their celebration for the time that God rescued them from Egypt. That time of celebration now becomes the time when they're going to be utterly destroyed. So in verse 8, Haman went to King Ahasuerus and he said, there is a certain people. Oh, I love this. It reminds me of so many people today. You know, ever notice people come to the preacher, they come to the elders or something like this? They'll say, some say, or that those are here who believe, and they'll mention some problem, you find out it's this man and his wife and daughter. But they say, they are saying, they're using the same tactic that Haman does here. He doesn't tell him who these people are. And Ahasuerus doesn't bother to ask, which doesn't show very much of a compliment to his ability to reign properly. But he says, these people don't keep the king's laws. And I'm very concerned about the revenue here, verse 9. You let me destroy all these and I'll bring ten thousand talents of silver into the hands of those who work to bring to the king's treasuries. Well, he took off his signet ring, the king did. The signet ring is like the seal that says, this stamp shows this is approved, it's authorized, it's been notarized, it's official. It's a blank check, basically, to Haman. Do what you please. So he does. The rest of chapter 3 shows their agreement to do this, and the last verse of chapter 3 is very eerie. It reminds me of the time during World War II when Adolf Hitler would go visit Himmler and say, how many did we kill today? And talk about the Jews who had been sent to the ovens. And upon finding the number, they would celebrate and go drink their wine and eat a nice meal. So here, while the Jews hear about this, and the Jews are fasting, and they're scared, and they wonder what's going to happen, the perpetrators of this great crime are feasting. That's the last part of chapter 3. Then in chapter 4, when Mordecai learned all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes. Went out into the midst of the city, he cried out with a loud and bitter cry, which was very, very dangerous. Verse 2 says he went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. Even in Nehemiah 2, you see that on the occasion that Nehemiah goes before the king and he's looking downcast, downtrodden, sad, he says, what is this? You're supposed to look happy in front of the king. Herodotus even goes so far as to say you couldn't spit in the king's presence, much less look sorrowful in his presence. There's just certain things you don't do. Well, he's doing this. And in verse 3, everywhere this decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Imagine driving through the city and see these people wallowing on the garbage dumps and ashes with dust on their head, crying out in agony. You wonder, what's happened? And you see the whole nation is scheduled to be executed. The numbers carved on them. You know when your day is. So they're scared. They're terrified. They're upset. Esther's maids and eunuchs in verse 4 told her that she sent garments to clothe Mordecai and take his sackcloth from him. He wouldn't receive them. Then she called Hatak, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her. The result of this is Mordecai told him what was going on, gave a copy to show to Esther. Well, he returned, told Esther the words of Mordecai, and in verse 10, Esther spoke to Hatak and gave him a command for Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner courts of the king who has not been called, he has but one law. Put all to death. That's the rule. Now, there's one exception to this rule. He holds out the golden scepter and says, you touch this and you're spared. That's the exception. But everybody else is put to death. You want me to go in and talk to the king on behalf of the Jews, begging not to let this occur? You don't realize I haven't been called for 5 months or for these 30 days. And in verse 12, they told Mordecai Esther's words. Well, if I go in there, I contradict Haman, I overset the king's seal, you know, it's not going to happen. Mordecai gave this famous response in verse 13. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Now, pause. Where did he get the idea that deliverance would arise? Where did he get the idea he would not have to go through this mass execution? Apparently, Mordecai knew the promise of God to Abraham. Through your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And he believes God. It looks horrible from the outside. Things have never looked bleaker for the Jewish nation than right here. But he believes God's promise. That's a lesson in itself. Then the last part of verse 14, yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Do you believe in the providence of God? Esther, who knows but what your beauty, you just happen to be in the right place at the right time with the right looks, right personality, everything else, at this particular moment, to be chosen by this king who just happens at this time to be in need of a wife, and you happen to be in the right place at the right time, and he brings you in to serve in this position to save his people. Who knows but what? That's why you're here. Well, in verse 15, she gave this reply. Verse 16, go gather all the Jews who are present in Susa and fast for me. Now, let's pause there. Why? Why fast? This book doesn't mention the name of God, does it? But he's implied. If there is no God, why fast? You might as well say, I'll go in 3 days, but in the meantime, trim your toenails. Why? If there's no God, why fast? Unless they believe that the fasting will move the God of heaven to act on their behalf. And that's precisely the case. And she says, for 3 days, day or night, don't eat. And I will fast likewise with my maids. And so I'll go into the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. What an attitude. What a girl. 17, Mordecai went his way and did what Esther had commanded him. Now in chapter 5, on the third day, fast for 3 days, but now on the third day, that's a Jewish reckoning, a part of a day equals a day, she put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace across from the king's house. And in verse 2, when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she found favor in his sight. He held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. He's lost one wife. He's learned his lesson. He's not going to lose another one. She went near and touched the top of the scepter, and he says, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you up to half the kingdom." Her response, "If it pleases the king." And I don't know if at this moment she gets cold feet and just can't go through with her request, or if she decides it's better to butter him up a little more first. The ways of a woman, who can tell? But the timing is going to work out exactly as God wants it to work out. "If it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I prepared for them." The king said, "Bring Haman quickly that he may do as Esther said." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther has prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition?" He knew she hadn't risked her life to ask him out to a dinner engagement. There's something else cooking here, as it generally is. "What is your petition? It shall be granted you. What do you request up to half the kingdom, and it shall be done?" And in verse 8, "If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request," then you wonder here, did she have to pause again? Did she get the cold feet again and just couldn't come out with it? She knows to pop the big question, but everything hangs on this big question, and if she doesn't do it just right, it could all be lost. And so she says, "Come to the banquet tomorrow that I prepared for the king." "Yes, we will. Now I'll do as the king has said." So in verse 9, Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. When Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against him. Worldly success leaves you empty. I don't care what worldly success you have. If that's all you have going for you, there's always going to be a fly in your ointment. It's going to upset you and make you unhappy. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. He called his wife Zeresh, a very practical woman, and his friends. And verse 11, he told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children. He's discussing his favorite subject, himself. And all that he had going for him, all that he had done, and how the king had promoted him above everybody. And besides that, to show you how great I am, in verse 12, "I'm the only one who was allowed into the private dining practice with the king and the queen. Nobody else. I'm the one." And yet, verse 13, "All this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high." That's about 75 feet, give or take a few inches. "And in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily." Get that. Do away with this killjoy and then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. After all, he's going to kill all the Jews, right? What's the harm in killing one of them a little early? He's going to die in a few months anyway. So in chapter 6, while they're out there banging, making that gallows, I wonder, the king can't sleep that night. And I've wondered if the noise of the gallows is probably what gives him insomnia. I don't know. But I do know in verse 1 of chapter 6, the king couldn't sleep. Of all nights for him to get insomnia, it happens to be this night. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. You know, when you can't sleep, the old saying is, "Call me up and I'll preach a little while and you'll be out in 2 minutes. I tell people, if you can't sleep, turn on Metro Council and you won't get through 15 words and you will be asleep unless you have a very serious problem. And so that's what's happening here. Bring me those Chronicles. Bring me the Metro Council meeting and let me know what's in our head. Let's catch up on a little bit of the bookwork. But surprise, he doesn't go to sleep. He finds something very interesting that hasn't been handled. In verse 2, it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers, who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. 5 long years have passed. Compare chapter 2, verse 16, with 3, verse 7. 5 years at least have passed since that time that he informed through Esther that there's an assassination attempt against the king, and not one thing, not even a thank you note had Mordecai received from the king. And now, 5 years later, he receives this information. Verse 3, what honor or dignity was done to Mordecai for this? And they said, nothing. So in verse 4, the king said, who's in the court? Haman had just entered at this particular time, of all times to come in. What a coincidence, right? Well, Haman comes in. He entered the outer court to suggest that the king kill the man he's just read about that had saved his life. See the timing here? Just when times look at their worst for the Jews, look what starts to happen. So in verse 5, the king's servant said to him, Haman is there. And the king said, let him come in. Haman came in, verse 6, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And of course, you know what Haman thinks. Who's worthy of more honor than I? I'm his favorite. Let me think, what would I like? Another blank check. Well, he obviously likes prestige and quite a lot of honor, and so he thinks, verse 8, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn. Now you're dressing up like the king. It's obvious to see what he would like. And a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head, both of which would be a capital offense to wear or to ride without the king's permission. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor, then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Give him the equivalent of a ticker tape parade with a noted official leading the cavalcade. Well, in verse 10, the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested and do so for Mordecai the Jew. Oh, imagine how those words sank. Yes, he's thinking about Haman all right, but not the one to honor, the one to give the honor. And to give the honor to the man who had refused to honor him. Oh, life just isn't fair sometimes when you're very proud. So in verse 11, Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, mourning and with his head covered. You see today, sometimes they catch the criminal, they handcuff him. What does he have over his head? A jacket, a sack, anything to cover his face. And that's the equivalent of what's being done here. In verse 13, when Haman told his wife and his friends everything that had happened, his wife, remember, she's a very practical woman. Well, you're having a problem with this man, just make a gallows and get rid of him. You understood what she said, and she's just as practical with her husband. If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. Now, that's not very comforting for a wife to say that, but she's right on target. So in verse 14, while they're talking, the king's eunuchs came and hastened Haman to the banquet. In chapter 7, they went into the banquet. On the second day, at the banquet of wine, the king again said to Esther, what is your petition? It shall be granted up to half the kingdom. And then in verse 3, she says, if I found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. And there's a play that runs through this book. Haman comes to the king and he says, there's a people, obnoxious people, they don't keep the law, let's get rid of these people. We don't know who they are, it's very vague. When Haman comes in, the king just as vaguely says, what should we do for some fellow that I would like to honor? And Haman assumes one thing, but he doesn't know because the king's been just as vague with him. And now she's being just as vague with the king. There is someone who has sold us not to slavery, or I wouldn't have opened my mouth, but to death. Imagine now the king sitting there hearing these words. He's lost one good woman. someone's threatening to take this one. Imagine the fury of the king's wrath. Verse 5, he demands to know, who is he, where is he, who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? And then imagine what Haman looked like when she said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman, the man you've promoted. Haman was terrified before the king and queen. I've thought for a long time that's one of the great understatements of Scripture. Sometimes I've heard Paul Harvey as he describes a crook that's not the most talented and not the most, learned. And he will do some very foolish things. It's foolish to be a crook anyway. But when everything is going wrong and they're taking him away, he's heard to say sometimes, according to Paul Harvey, I might as well not worry. Nothing's going to turn out all right anyway. And I wonder if that's what Haman was thinking here. It's too late to worry. I'm done for. But he makes an attempt. Verse 7 tells us, the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the palace garden. But Haman, who's just learned that one of these people on whom he's placed this contract for death is none other than the king's own wife. Quite a revelation. Haman stood before Queen Esther pleading for his life. He begs for his life from one whose life he was going to take. He didn't know she was one of them. But I see some irony here. Pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. Another great understatement in the Scriptures. In verse 8, when the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Not exactly a politically correct position to be in when the husband returns. And the question from the king then, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? Earlier, Haman could do no wrong. He was the rising young prince of the day. Now he can do no right. And as soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face, as if to say he's no longer worthy to look upon the king's face. Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf. You know that man who saved your life? He has a gallows out there ready to kill him tomorrow, if you give permission. That didn't go over very well. You talk about icing on the cake here. The king said to him, hang him on it. So the honor that Mordecai prepared for himself went to Mordecai. The gallows he prepared for Mordecai comes to him. What great things God can do. Then the king's wrath subsided. Well, in chapter 8, on that day, King Ahasuerus gave Queen Esther the house of Haman. She owns them. It wasn't just Haman who went down, but all the people. And this was very typical in the ancient world. When a fellow went down, they took everything he had and it belonged to the one who conquered. The king took off his signet ring, and instead of giving it to Haman, it goes to Mordecai. Mordecai basically replaced Haman. Now, he can't undo this law. The law of the Medes and Persians can't be changed. But there are ways to get around such things. So the law has to stand. The law is, on this particular day, on this particular month of Adar, around March or beginning of April, you have the right to kill all the Jews. But, here's the fine print that we're going to add. We can't change the law, but we will give the Jews the right to defend themselves and to kill you if you come at them. And so that's what they do. That's basically chapter 8. They sent those letters out. And then verse 16, the Jews had light and gladness, joy and honor. And the last verse of chapter 8 says, in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews. They became Jews because fear of the Jews fell upon them. Now, 2 points in chapter 9, and then we'll make some brief applications to these thoughts. In chapter 9, verse 1, in the 12th month, the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed. On the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, get this, the opposite occurred. Now remember what we saw earlier in chapter 3? They went to the poor, the casting of the lots, the astrological charts. Tell us what is the very best day in favor with all the positions of the stars and the heavenly bodies. What is the very best time to kill the Jews? They said, this particular day of Adar. All right, we have it. What's this say in chapter 9, verse 1? The very opposite occurred. The stars didn't know. A major blow against astrology. The idols are wrong. And then the 10 sons of Haman are destroyed, chapter 9, verse 10. But the Jews didn't lay hand on the plunder. They were just defending themselves. They weren't after some kind of unusual reward. And then they extended it another day. They let Haman's 10 sons be hanged on the gallows. And they killed several more. And yet, verse 16, they didn't lay hands on the plunder. And then, verse 18, the second major point I want to say. But the Jews who were at Shushan, Susa, assembled together on the 13th day as well as on the 14th and on the 15th of the month. They rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Problems are all gone. Happy days are here again because something happened. What is it? Verse 22. As the days on which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which, get this, was turned. That's what's called by many a divine passive. We talk about an active voice. Boy hits the ball. The boy is doing something to this object, this direct object. But you can turn that around. The boy is hit by the ball. Now the boy is passive. He's not doing anything. He's receiving the action. But somebody, unnamed, did something to that ball to cause this result. Here you have, in this voice, a divine passive. It doesn't say God turned it around, but it says, as the month which was turned, divine passive, without naming God, He's clearly behind this action, from sorrow to joy for them and from mourning to a holiday. And that's how the Purim, verse 26, came into being. As far as lessons from this book, there are many and they are numerous. I want to suggest four very quickly. In chapter 2, verse 23, as a result of Mordecai's obedience to God, God blessed him and God blessed the Jewish people. Here's the first principle. God's blessings, His greatest blessings, are always reserved for those who obey Him. I know that God's sunshine, His rain, come upon the just and the unjust, the good and the evil. That's something all of us share in alike. But God's greatest blessings, the spiritual blessings in Christ Jesus, come to those who obey Him. You see this here. Jeremiah 29:7, a rather obscure passage, tells the Jews, when you go into captivity into a foreign land, you work for the welfare of that land. You work for the peace of it. You pray for those people. Because in their peace is your peace. When they prosper, you prosper. If Mordecai had held the view that many today hold, I've been mistreated, I'll never get over it, Xerxes doesn't care anything for me, why should I care about him? Let them kill the guy. There's nothing to him anyway. What would have happened? What would have happened? But because Mordecai obeyed, God worked through Mordecai to bless not only himself but all the other Jews. What would you think? You're riding through one of these East Tennessee roads and you see these beautiful hills around. You look over in one of the fields and there's this tree, a limb about 20 feet off the ground. There's this fellow out there hanging on just like this. You think, that's awfully unusual. You drive on and 15 minutes, you have to go back by that way, the opposite direction. He's still out there. Have to go see what's going on here. And so you park the car and get out and go out and say, fellow, you're hanging in a tree. What's going on here? He says, well, several years ago, there was a flood that came through this valley, this gully right here. It scared me so bad. I got up in this tree. I've been hanging up here for 20 years. You mean you hadn't come down in 20 years? No. I'm not coming down. I'll go to my grave in this tree. He said, how ridiculous. Such a thing couldn't occur. And that's absolutely right. But you know how many people I've talked to who have allowed 20, 30, 40, or 50 years go by? And they're still hanging on to a grudge because of what someone did to them years ago, and they're going to go to their grave holding that grudge. They don't know how to forgive. They don't know how to forget. And they don't realize that by burning that bridge by which they gain access to God, they destroy themselves. Because every time you're unwilling to forgive and unwilling to let something go by and do whatever it requires to get over this, you're burning the bridge by which God can forgive you. What a sad, sad state of affairs. May that never be said of us. The second principle, not only does God truly and richly bless those who obey Him, but in chapter 4, verse 14, God's providence can never be a substitute for human responsibility. I believe very strongly in the providence of God. But I cannot allow God's providence to be a substitute for my responsibility. I have things I must do if I'm going to be a part of God's plan and a part of God's providence. Several years ago, two men went out to a farmhouse, knocked on the door, and invited a family to a gospel meeting. I don't know if they were aware of this fact, but that mother and father had been thinking about going somewhere, and why not there? And so they decided to attend that meeting. The local preacher there said, I'd be glad to come out and tell you more about it. And they said that'd be fine. For the next 6 weeks, every Monday night he came out. They studied. They started in the Old Testament. They went all the way through the New, as much you can cover in 6 weeks. By the time they got through, this man who had been raised in a denominational church and this woman who had been baptized as a girl but only because others had done it and all she had done had gotten wet, both said, we realize we haven't done what we need to do. We need to become Christians. And they did that night. At the end of the sixth study, a year later, their oldest son obeyed the gospel and then later two others. I was 12 years old when Dwayne Lamb and Speedy Broyles knocked on our door that day. 12 years old. And I really believe that if a person wants to know the truth, eventually he will be able to find that truth. I believe that's the promise of John 7:17. But here were two men, Dwayne Lamb and Speedy Broyles, who were willing to take part of their afternoon to go out and be used by the Lord to accomplish what God wanted them to do. And I've often wondered what things would have been like had they not come to our house that day. They could have sat home and said, well, God's providence is going to take care of it. If somebody wants to know the truth, He'll know the truth. But they wouldn't have had any part to play in it. And then that brings us to a third part of this lesson. There's no such thing as an ordinary life. I know what many people think when you talk about knocking on somebody's door or offering to study the Bible with someone. There are people who think, well, that's Ron's job and he's very good at it. That's the elder's job and they're very good at it. But don't ask me to do it. I'm just an ordinary Christian. You know what Dwayne Lamb was? He was a bookkeeper. You know what Speedy Broyles was? He was a church janitor. He made enough money that some Sundays he could put as much as a quarter in the contribution. Didn't even own a car. And he got his nickname because he could walk rapidly. Speedy Broyles and Dwayne Lamb were ordinary people, unless you want to call someone ordinary when he helps to lead other people to a study of the truth that saves their souls. Ordinary people must be a part of God's plan because He made so many of us. I love the story of the three trees. They're standing on this hill as young trees and they all have their dreams. One of them says as he looks up at the stars, I'd like to become someday a great treasure chest and hold the greatest treasures in the world. The second one said as he looked at the babbling brook that flowed by, I would like nothing better than to become a great sailing vessel and sail around the world and carry kings and conquer the waves and conquer nations. And the third one said, I don't want to leave this mountain at all. I want to stay up here and become the biggest tree in the world and give glory to God just by virtue of my presence. Time passed. Years went by. One day, three woodcutters came up on that mountain. They came up. One of them came up to the first tree and he said, this one will serve my purposes. He whacked it down. The tree was so excited. Today I become a treasure chest. Well, they didn't have any need for a treasure chest that day. They made it into a feed box. It was covered with sawdust and straw and cow slobber. It didn't see its dreams fulfilled. Wipe down the second tree. Oh, great. Now I'm going to become a great sailing vessel. They didn't need any great sailing vessels this day. They needed a fishing boat. And every day, he carried loads of stinky, smelly fish. Not exactly illustrious. The third one, he didn't want to be cut down at all, but they cut him down, made him into huge timbers, pieces of wood, threw it on a pile and forgot it. Years passed. One night, the night was brighter, the lights were brighter, the stars were shinier than usual. And this family who could find no room in the inn found this place where animals typically stayed. And when she brought forth her son, she laid him in this place where the cows fed, where the animals ate. And these shepherds came and they talked about this vision they had seen of these angels. And this animal trough realized now it's holding the greatest treasure in all the universe, after all. Years went by and this baby grew and he was a tired man on a boat on one occasion with his 12 disciples. And this storm comes up as they're in this fishing boat. And he stands up and he says, "Peace, be still." And all is quiet and calm. And suddenly this boat, made from the second tree, realizes it is carrying the King of the universe. It wasn't ordinary either. Then the third one, on one occasion, had a Roman soldier come up and grab him out of that pile. And he took the shivering body of this man and they pierced his hands and his feet and used him to crucify. All he wanted to do was glorify God, and now he becomes the means by which the only perfect person who ever lived is crucified. But in reality, on that third day, things begin to happen. He comes forth from the grave, and now that tree realizes he too has had a part to play in the plan of God. And the moral of that story is this. There's no such thing as an ordinary tree. There's no such thing as an ordinary person. That story, of course, is fictitious. But the application of it is as real as you are. Whatever you are, whatever you think you are, how untalented you think you are, how do you know but what you could be a Dwayne Lamb and a Speedy Broyles? Who I don't think either one ever preached a sermon in his life, though both were good Bible students. But they sure had impact on some people. You could be that person. It could be that Ron can't go. People are kind of scared of preachers for some reason. I don't know why. But they may relax around you. It could be your next door neighbor. And it could be that you're the only person who has that kind of access to open up the door of the gospel to that individual. What are you going to do about that? Don't think you're ordinary and cannot do what you're placed here to do. Then the final lesson, chapter 9. God has the ability to turn a fast into a feast. Here's an occasion where the Jews at this particular time, at this particular month, are mourning to see it come. But when it does come, the fast becomes a feast. And they see that this God who has this great power not only has delivered us, but brought us the greatest joy. And I remember an occasion as the Lord instructed His disciples that people are going to take me, they're going to crucify me. And I'm telling you by now, and your hearts are breaking, but understand that it is expedient, it's helpful for you that I go away, because better things are yet to come. You need to have some trust that that will be so, and it was so. I was in a meeting at a place where a young man preaching there had been diagnosed with a brain tumor. They had operated on his brain, managed to get most of the tumor. After a while it grew back, but after talking to him about 30 seconds, it was obvious he was not at all worried. He said, "I've often wondered in days prior to this tragedy that came, how strong my faith was." He said, "I've wondered what it would be like to face death knowing that I have a very high likelihood of dying and what my faith would do for me on that occasion." And he said, "I am so happy to report it will stand you in good stead." And he can look back on that what we would call great tragedy, very dark time in his life, with great rejoicing. I would pray that you have that kind of faith this evening, that you are serving the Lord who can turn the worst circumstances in life from a fast to a feast. Could it be that someone in this audience has never rendered obedience to the Lord? This is the only time you know you have. Would you repent and be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins? If you've done this and have wandered astray, that's what sheep often do, and you need to be put right and come back to the fold, confess what you've done. Won't you respond to His invitation? While together we stand and sing.